An educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on global warming when we come back. You know, in Job 38, verse 24, we read a scientific question. It says, "By what way is it that the light is parted?" Or if we paraphrased it, it would say, "By what way or technique is the light apportioned or separated?" Now imagine asking that question 4,000 years ago. It is today, of course, a simple question and answer, and the student simply replies by passing it through the prism of the spectroscope. But who could have known that 4,000 years ago in Job's day? And since it's manifestly impossible for any human mind to frame a question that the mind knows nothing of, a greater mind than Job is the questioner here. But when we heat a metal red hot or heat any substance until it's incandescent, it gives forth rays of light. These rays, after passing through the prism of the spectroscope, divide themselves on the graph according to the content of the matter that sent them forth. So when a ray of light reaches us from some far-flung star, all we have to do is pass that ray of light through the spectroscope to see what the composition of that star is and the proportion of each of its ingredients. Now this division of light rays is always constant and it doesn't vary in the least particular, so that we may always rely upon the results. Spectroscopic analysis is an exact science, and this is the manner by which the light is apportioned, which places us in a quandary, because either Job knew this, or else a supernatural wisdom is being revealed here. Now that's just one more of the many examples of science in the scripture, and it's one of the many lessons in our Mosaic Law School that we teach here in Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, last time we were talking about the medieval period, the Little Ice Age, the cold period from about 1300 to about 1800. There was a medieval warm period from 800 to 1300. Now, these dates are kind of approximate. We can't say that in 1326 at 4:30 in the afternoon on March 17th, this Little Ice Age began, and on December the 9th, 1806, it ended. It's not quite that exact science, but it's pretty close, because through dendrochronology, that is the study of tree rings, and the study of sediments on the ocean floor, especially off of the mouths of places where the volcanoes run into the ocean, or where the glaciers run into the ocean, and we can measure. And after all, that's what science is all about. It's where we actually take physical measurements. And then when we do the computations, we can actually come up with some hard science. So when we're talking about global warming, we're not talking about a phenomenon that's never happened in the past and that we're observing it today and we haven't got a clue as to what the outcome is going to be in the future. It has occurred in historical times, and we would infer from that that more logically it's probably occurred in non-historical times, way, way back. How many times, we don't know, but we know of two. That from 800 to 1300, the world experienced a warming trend for which we have historical records. People actually wrote it down, and we can go back to those records and we can read about it. In addition to that, we have the physical measurements that we can make today, looking back at those physical records, historical records. And then we can extrapolate that forward into today, and we can say, well, if the world warms up today like it did between 800 and 1300, what are the likely results? It probably will have just about the same results as it had between 8 and 1300, and it was something less than catastrophic then, so why would we think that it's going to be catastrophic today? Now remember, I said, keep your eye on the ball, and the ball in the global warming debate is a $250 billion carbon tax. That's the ball. That's the objective. That's what we're after. In order for us to pass a law to get you to pay a dollar a gallon more for gasoline, we've got to scare the living hell out of you, Joe. I mean, we've got to get you so psyched up that you're willing to sign on and stand in line to pay your money. And that's the way we do it. We first of all create a crisis. It's the Iraq war all over again. We create a crisis by knocking down two buildings. then we blame it on somebody. We say, okay, well, here's the culprit, and now here's the solution. We got to go do something about it. Then after we get the laws passed and we get the war started, then we find out there's no weapons of mass destruction. Now what do you do, Joe? Nothing. The war is on, and it's going to be on for years to come. Just make up your mind to it. That's the way it is. All right, now, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. That's an old Chinese proverb. Well, now, I told you about the communists. They have a tried, tested, and proven modality for achieving their political ends. That is, you demand a gigantic slice of the pie, knowing full well that you're not going to get the whole thing. But after all, it's your pie. And so I come up to you and I say, give me half of your pie. And if you don't give me half of your pie, we're going to get in a big, nasty fight. And then you say, well, you're not going to get half my pie. And so I come back and I say, well, then get ready for the fight. And then you say, well, you know, maybe instead of the fight, maybe I might give you a smell of my pie. And I say, for a smell, hell, we'll just go to war. And so pretty soon you say, well, okay, I'm going to give you a piece of my pie. And so I come back and I say, well, okay, I'll take a piece of your pie. So you give me 1/8 of your pie and I walk off. And here's what the net result is. Number one, it's your pie. Number two, I don't have any claim on it. Number three, I'm not entitled to even a smell of your pie. But because of my threats and my blustering and my demands, I walk away with 1/8 of your pie and with your consent. And then we use your knife to cut it. Now, that's a tried and tested and proven modality for success. It has never failed. It has always worked. It is working today, and it will always continue to work. And that's because of vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear, the five motivators of human nature. Fear. And we actually don't want to fight. We only fight when we actually have to. It's what we call the flight or fight response. So human beings naturally do not like confrontation. Well, at least 95% of us don't. Now, 5% of us do. And then that's because 5% of us are extroverts and 95% of us are introverts, and the extroverts are the movers and shakers in the world. So that 5% comes to the 95%, the majority of us, and they make these demands upon us. And so when these demands are made, we don't want a fight. We don't want a confrontation. And so when it comes to race, politics, religion, the subjects and topics that are so divisive, so we would rather go along to get along than we would to create a confrontation to settle the issue once and for all. And so that's what the modality is being used here, that is the modality being used here in the game of global warming. You have some activists, they come along and they make these demands, they make these claims. They're outrageous, they don't have any basis at all in fact, but they make these claims. Then another group of people comes along and says, well, no, that's not true, and here's why. And so the original group comes back and they jump up and down, paw the ground, throw themselves on the ground, have an apoplectic fit. And then in order to bring peace, we say, well, maybe they've got a point, so maybe we should listen. So we listen. And the news media is the lapdog of politics. I mean, the news media doesn't have anything to report on unless they go down and talk to the police and the fire department. Just take a look at your 6 o'clock news. What are they reporting on? They're reporting on police reports, fire department reports, and then the political reports. They go down to the city council and the mayor's office, and that's what your evening news is all about. It's a canned program that repeats itself day after day after day, and it's called the news. You know, so Joe's house burned down, so they get out there. Then they got sports and weather. So the sports guy, he tells you about the sports news, and then the weather guy, he tells you about the weather news. And all we're dealing with here is the weather news. That's what global warming is all about. It's the weather news. It's a part and parcel of a canned program that we hear day in and day out. And propaganda is made up with this constant repetition. If we constantly repeat, global warming is real, global warming is here, global warming is a catastrophe waiting to happen, pretty soon we begin to believe it. And lacking the fortitude, lacking the gall, if that's the right word to use, to face, confront, and cross-examine your accuser, we go along with it. We say, oh, okay, because we don't want to fight with them. They want to fight with us. We don't want to fight with them. Now, if we actually get down to where we have to fight, I guess we will, but not unless we have to. And so your opponent is very wise, very wise. He never brings the confrontation down to an actual fight. He's just threatening the fight until you finally back off. He pushes you as far as he can push you. And then he backs off, you give him some of what he wants, and then he goes away. Then he comes back on a different front at a different time later and makes these same outrageous demands. And this goes on and on and on ad infinitum. And that's what we're facing here with global warming. So I took a look at global warming, and I'm making my report, and I'm sitting here saying, this thing doesn't have any merit at all. Now listen to this story as it relates to medieval warm period. The medieval warm period called the MWP. Remember in the last program we had the little ice age, the LIA. Well, they call this the MWP, or the medieval climate optimum, was a time of universally warm climate in the North Atlantic region, lasting from about the 10th century to about the 14th century. The MWP is often invoked in contentious discussions of global warming. Some refer to the event as the medieval climactic anomaly, as this term emphasizes that effects other than temperature were important. The medieval warm period was a time of warm weather around 800 to 1300 AD during the European medieval period. Initially, research on the MWP and the following Little Ice Age was largely done in Europe, where the phenomenon was most obvious and clearly documented. It was initially believed that the temperature changes were global. However, this view has been questioned. The 2001 IPCC report summarizes this research by saying, "Current evidence does not support globally synchronous periods of anomalous cold or warmth over this time frame, and the conventional terms of the Little Ice Age and the medieval warm period appear to have limited utility in describing trends in hemispheric or global mean and mean temperatures changes in the past centuries." The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, called NOAA, N-O-A-A, states that the idea of a global or hemispheric medieval warm period that was warmer than today, however, has turned out to be incorrect, and that those records that do exist show is that there was no multi-century periods when global or hemispheric temperatures were the same or warmer than in the 20th century. Paleoclimatologists developing region-specific climate reconstructions of past centuries conveniently labeled their coldest interval as LIA, that's the Little Ice Age, and their warmest interval as the MWP, that is the medieval warm period. Others follow the convention, and when a significant climate event is found in the LIA or MWP timeframes, associate their events to the period. Some MWP events are thus wet events or cold events rather than strictly warm events, particularly in central Antarctica, where climate patterns opposite to the North Atlantic area have been noticed. Here are some of the climate events in the North Atlantic and the North American regions. The Vikings took advantage of the ice-free seas to colonize Greenland and other outlying lands to the far north. The MWP was followed by the Little Ice Age, a period of cooling that lasted until the 19th century. In the Chesapeake Bay, researchers found large temperature excursions during the medieval warm period, about 800 to 1300, and the Little Ice Age, about 1400 to 1850, possibly related to changes in the strength of North Atlantic thermohaline circulation. Sediments in Pyrmont Marsh of the lower Hudson Valley show a dry medieval warm period from about 800 to 1300 AD. Prolonged droughts affected many parts of the western United States, and especially eastern California and the western Great Basin. Alaska experienced three time intervals of comparable warmth. The first was from 1 to 300 AD, the second from 850 to 1200 AD, and the third was from 1800 to the present. A radiocarbon-dated box score in the Sargasso Sea shows that the sea surface temperature was approximately 1 degree centigrade cooler than today, approximately 400 years ago, during the period that we call the Little Ice Age. 1700 years ago, and approximately 1 degree centigrade warmer than today, 1,000 years ago, which was called the medieval warm period. I want to pause here and point out, the people today that are advocating this global warming alarmism are saying that the temperatures are going to rise another 1 to 3 degrees. In the past, it has already been as warm as or warmer than that. And the end of the world did not occur during the last warm period. Now, we're in a warming period right now, which began about 1800. It isn't over yet. That warming period began around 1800, and here it is, 200 years into the warming cycle, and it's still getting warmer, which tells us what? Which is exactly what we would expect. You don't get a temperature rise over a 400 or 500 year period. Now think about this. Well, think about it. The period from 800 to 1300 is 500 years. Well, did the temperature rise on year one and remain for the 500 years, or during the 500 years did it slowly rise until it reached its peak, and then did it change? And then how gradual or how rapid was the change that led to the Little Ice Age? Did the temperature suddenly drop in 1315 by 3 degrees, or did they slowly over a long period of time from 1300 to 1800, which was another 500 years, go down? And then from 1800 until today, are they slowly rising for another 500 years, which means we still have another 300 years of temperature rises to go through before we reach a cooling trend again. Now, we've already been through this, and it's been historically documented, which is a hell of a lot better than the global fanatics who are running around telling us that the end of the world is coming. Now, it is true the end of the world is coming, but for far bigger, better reasons than global climate change. These guys have their eye on the ball. Their ball is how do we make money? There are worse problems afoot, boys and girls, than global warming. Global warming is going to turn out to be the pimple on the elephant's trunk. It's the flea climbing up the elephant's leg with rape on his mind. It is a total non-consequential event. But there's more. The climate in equatorial East Africa has alternated between drier than today and relatively wet. The drier climate took place during the medieval warm period, from 1000 to 1270. An ice core from the eastern Bronzefield Basin in the Antarctic Peninsula clearly identifies events of the Little Ice Age and the medieval warm period. The core clearly shows a distinctly cold period about 1000 to 1100, neatly illustrating the fact that MWP is a movable term and that during the warm period there were regionally periods of both warmth and cold. We see that going on today. Just this past week in our local region here, we had a 14-inch rainfall. A storm blew in here from Texas and in 3 days dumped 14 inches of rain on Isabella, Missouri. Why, that's unheard of. We've never had rainstorms like that. Not here. I've heard of rainstorms like that in Houston, Texas, and places along the Gulf Coast where hurricanes come in and 14-inch rainfalls occur, but that doesn't happen here. Okay, but that doesn't mean that it can't, nor that it hasn't in the past. Hell, maybe 200 or 300 years ago, we used to have regularly 14-inch rainstorms. I don't know. I just know that here, if it rains 3-4 inches, that's humongous rain. And then all of a sudden, here comes this gigantic 14-inch rainfall, interspersed with other periods. Now, we've been going through drought here over the past 10 years. It's been warmer than normal, or at least warmer than the previous 10 years. And then there are periods of time when it varies. If you average that over 100 years, this 14-inch rainfall that just occurred, averaged over 100 years, isn't going to amount to jack squat. But averaged over 1 year, it's really going to spike our rainfall for this year, because already we're 20 inches above normal. We were above normal rainfall for this time of year before this 14-inch rain. I think it was 6 inches above normal before this rain came about. So those anomalies are a part and parcel of a long-term trend. And we're in a long-term trend of global warming, which began about 1800 and is still going on and is going to continue going on. How hot is it going to get? I don't know. Is it going to rise another 3 degrees? If it did, it will match the warm period back in the Middle Ages from 8 to 1300. Because it was warmer then than it is now. Now, prolonged droughts affected many parts of the western United States, especially eastern California and the Great Plains, or the Western Great Basin. And Alaska experienced three time intervals of comparable warmth, from 1 to 300, 850 to 1200, and then 1800 to the present. A radiocarbon box dated the Sargasso Sea shows that the sea surface temperature was approximately 1 degree centigrade cooler than today. All right, now let's think about that. The variations of temperature during the warm period, a 500-year period of warming trends, has short-term cooling trends in with it. Let me give you an illustration. Back in the 1950s, they were measuring the flow of the Colorado River at around 15 to 17 million acre-feet per year. They came to the conclusion that this was normal. So they allocated the water out of the Colorado River for Arizona, Colorado, and the state of California based upon those rates of flow, 15 to 17 million acre-feet a year. Now the flow is running 5 to 7 million acre-feet, about half what it was, one-third to one-half. And now there's these great shortages of water. So they get to looking back over time and they say, we made a little boo-boo here. Come to find out, there have been times in the past when the Colorado River ran 5 to 7 million acre-feet. Well, boys and girls, let's just take a couple of numbers here. Let's take 7 and 17. 7 and 17. And then let's divide that by 2 and we get 12. The correct number should have been around 12 million averaged over a long period of time. How long a period of time? Well, going back to 1500 to the present is 500 years. Over that period of 500 years, the average flow of the river is 12 million, not 15 to 17 million. There are times when it runs as low as 5 and times when it runs as high as 17. We get the same thing in temperature, boys and girls. There are times when we have cold periods and there are times when we have warm periods. When we average that over 500 years, which most of us can't do. Hell, our lifespans are only 70. That's why I'm telling you, it's better to leave the temperature and the climate to God. It's something that's beyond our control. It's something a little bigger than mankind. The guy that created the sun is in a better position to regulate the temperature on planet Earth than Al Gore and the Republican Party. But that's precisely what they're preparing to do. The people in politics, the people in the military, they know that if they can control the weather, they can control planet Earth. And that's what their game plan is. See, the military, they want to be able to control weather. They want to be able to bring a drought upon Russia. They would like to, here in this country, be able to shut off all rain in Russia and China. And of course, the Russians and the Chinese would like to be able to shut off all the rain in Western Europe and the United States or North America. If they could do that, they could control us. And of course, from our point of view, we don't want them to do that. We don't want them to have that kind of power, and with good reason. Now, the creator of the universe makes it rain upon the Chinese, the Russians, and the Americans equally. He's given us our inheritance. He makes it rain. He controls the temperature. And so far, it's been working out pretty well for all of us. Now, God help us if any one of those three groups over there ever gets control of the weather. Because if, and this isn't too big of an if they should be able to do that, which they're working mightily to do, God help the other guys on the other side. And then, can you imagine what the Russian and Chinese response is going to be when they find out that the Americans are controlling the weather over, let's say, Russia and China, and that they're shutting off the rain, or they're causing it to get extremely cold, or causing it to get extremely warm? I can guarantee you the war will be the result, and vice versa. So, you know, you can push and push and push, but there's an ultimate end to this, and it's called the Great Tribulation in Bible prophecy. But in Genesis chapter 11, there's a little story over here that we ought to take a look at. Genesis chapter 11. And there was a separation of all of the races. And God divided up all of the races, and he gave us an inheritance. And then he dispersed the people of the world. It was called the Tower of Babel. And during this period called the Tower of Babel, the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. It came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go and let us make brick and turn them thoroughly, and or burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime they had for mortar. And they said, go to and let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach into heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Eternal, the Creator God, came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they all have one language. And this they begin to do. And here's the clause. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. That is a powerful scientific statement. Nothing will be restrained from them that they have imagined to do. When God designed us, he designed us with a brain, something that is far in excess of what we see in dolphins and chimpanzees and gorillas. And that mind that we have, that power to reason, is something that the animals don't have. It's something that God has and that he has imparted to us. And then he says to us, he says, nothing that you people have imagined is going to be restrained from you. We imagine space travel. We imagine control of the weather. We imagine nuclear weapons, and we have achieved all of them. Now, boys and girls, that ought to be real scary. If there's anything ought to scare the hell out of you, that statement right there is. Fortunately, God says that when this thing reaches critical mass, he's going to intervene and he's going to stop it before we destroy ourselves. But the Messiah made this observation. It's in Matthew chapter 24. He said in Matthew 24 that there's coming a time when if he doesn't intervene, it's in verse 22, I believe it is, verse 22, and except those days should be shortened, yeah, that's what it is. There should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. There is a real critical mass period of time coming called the Great Tribulation. We're not there yet. And the reason I know we're not there is because in that same chapter, chapter 24, when he was asked for the signs by his disciples concerning his second coming, he said, do you see these stones in this building? Do you see this temple? He said, not one stone will be left upon another. As long as that wailing wall, which is the foundation to Herod's temple, is still there, we're all safe from the Great Tribulation. But those stones are coming down at some indefinite time in the future. And when those stones come down, boys and girls, there's going to be hell to pay. And the Messiah said in that same Matthew 24, he said, there's never been a time like it from the foundation of the earth to the present. And he said, no, and there never will be again. He likened that to something greater, something more traumatic, something more dramatic, something more terrible than Noah's flood, if you can believe that. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here now that we have completed this medieval warm period. That was the first half of tonight's program. And we'll be back here in just a minute after I give you a friendly reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct. That number is 417-273-4967. All right, now, there is a propaganda blitz going on concerning global warming, and that is that there is a consensus among scientists that global warming is real. Now, that's only part of the story. As I mentioned to you earlier, a part of propaganda or a part of a deception is telling you the truth. A warming trend has been going on since 1800. Global warming is real. The cause of global warming, we don't know. And the cause of global warming is not carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We know that scientifically, but the propagandists are telling us that global warming is going on. It started just recently, about 1940, with the burning of fossil fuels, and that the resulting carbon dioxide gas is causing the global warming, for which we need a solution. And the solution is a $1 per gallon carbon tax. Now, they've already created a carbon tax on big industry. That's what you hear about on the news, where a power plant or some business is trading its carbon allotment to, or selling their carbon allotment to some other dirty industry over here that's polluting the atmosphere. Now, what their next move is that they want to move this into the gasoline, because after all, that gasoline now is what you and I are buying and we're paying for as consumers. And the trick to making humongous amounts of money isn't to go to Bill Gates and take all of his money away from him, because the number of people who have a lot of money, like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and Jimmy Rogers, if we went out and took all of those three guys' money away from them, it would be a drop in the bucket. The money, the big money, is where you go to 100 million Americans and you take $1 from each one of them. Boys and girls, that's $100 million. That's one-tenth of a billion. You do that 10 times, it's 10 bucks. And when you take $10 from 100 million people, you got a billion. When you take 100 bucks from that same 100 million people, you got 100 billion. When you take $1,000 from that same 100 million people, you got $1 trillion. That's where the money's at. So the politicians, the big guys, the bankers, they recognize if you go out here and you hit these people suddenly, hard, you cause a lot of damage. So the trick is you just go to them and you just take a little bit and they'll never miss it. You take a dollar from 100 million people, hell, they never miss it. Now let me show you how important this is. It used to be when you bought a 303 can of something, you got 1 pound. Those were 1 pound cans. A can of beans was 1 pound. A can of sauerkraut was 1 pound. All right. Now, it's true they were cheating us. If they had something that was a little light, they just add a little more water to it to make it 1 pound. But now they've gotten a little craftier. So they lowered the 1 pound down to 15.5 ounces. So they took one half of an ounce. And then they went to 15 ounces. Now they're down to 14 and a half to 14 ounces. So here you got 1 pound cans that only have 14 ounces. I just got a few cases of pineapple in the other day here at the school. And I got to looking at them. These came from Thailand, these cans of pineapple. And so, as my habit is, I look at the weight on the cans, and they're 14 ounces. Now, I can remember back just a few years ago when those were 16-ounce cans, the 303-size cans, were 16 ounces. So they took 2/16, that's 1/8. Well, 1/8 is 12%. So what they did was they raised the price 12.5% by subtracting the 2 ounces out of the can. And you see what they're doing there? All right. Now, you know, when I buy a can of pineapple, the difference between 16 ounces and 14 ounces is 12%. It's practically unnoticeable. But let's suppose that you're a manufacturer and you're turning out, you know, tens of thousands of cans of pineapple. Well, the difference between 12%, you know, that's a 12% price increase. If you're selling those cans of pineapple for, let's say, $1 a can, what we're actually doing here is charging $1.125 a can. That's the net result of it. So we sell 100,000 cans, we get $12,500 more off of this production run than we got off of the last production run. Now, it's indistinguishable one can at a time, but $12,500 off of each production run that this company is making, and let's suppose that they run 100,000 cans a week. They're making an extra $12,000 a week. Well, let's take $12,000 a week times 52, and then we got $6,240,000 in it. Now, what we're talking about here is big money. We're talking about big bucks, but we're just taking a little bit at a time from each guy out here. It's an indistinguishable amount. And it's the old story of the gradualism of the camel sticking his nose in the camel's tent, or into your tent. The camel sticks his nose in, okay, that's reasonable. Pretty soon he sticks his snout in, well, that's reasonable. Pretty soon he sticks his head in, we have to move a little bit. And then pretty soon he sticks his neck in, we have to move a little more. Pretty soon he sticks his shoulders in, now we're up next to the flap of the door. Now he moves half of his body in, now we have to move our legs outside. And pretty soon he moves his whole body in, then we're half out. Pretty soon he moves his hind legs in, and we're out in the sandstorm, and the camel has taken over the tent by gradualism. And we don't even know what happened. The camel's in our tent, we're out in the cold, and we don't know what's happened. Now, the same thing is true with communism and gradualism. When they started off in 1848 with the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, they didn't have anything. By 1900, they had installed some of those planks to the Communist Manifesto into our public life, such as free education for all children in public school. When Franklin Roosevelt was elected president, he went to work hot and heavy. Today, if you take a look at the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, looking back to Karl Marx, who first published these 10 planks in 1848 at the International Socialist Union in Paris, France, 1848, until today, 150 years later, we Americans are practicing all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and not a single one of the 10 commandments or the 10 principles of our Bill of Rights is being practiced in Communist China or Communist Russia. They have totally engulfed us in their 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. We have not even got a suggestion of the 10 commandments into the politics of Russia or China. They have converted us from the 10 commandments to the 10 planks, and we haven't done anything in reciprocity. Now, that's gradualism. It took 150 years. We accept communism in the United States of America like we invented it. You send your children to public school like it's just been normal and we've always done it. No, we haven't. Take a look at your Constitution again. There's no provision for any public school in your Constitution. None. Zero. Zilch. And yet the federal government is funding public school at every level. President Bush came up with a program here called No Child Left Behind. The federal government should not be involved in public school at all. Nothing. Zero. Nada. They're totally involved in public school. They dictate the curriculum to every state in the union. Every school district in this country is governed by the mandates of the federal government. That's the implementation of the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. I could go through all 10 planks and show you exactly how that works. And I have in the past many times. Now, they're doing the same thing here with global warming. And they did it by coming to us and telling us that we've got consensus. Now, what consensus are we talking about? Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes the other day likened your denial of global warming to being a Holocaust denier. If you deny that there's global warming, then you're a Holocaust denier. All right. Well, I'll plead guilty to both of those. Now, let's take a look at it pragmatically, and let's see whether Scott Pelley is correct. Propaganda is propaganda. Truth is something else. Just because you say something doesn't make it true. And just because you believe it doesn't make it true. All kinds of people believe all kinds of things that aren't true, like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I mean, we all believed it because that's what they told us, and we didn't have any reason not to believe it. Now we find out that that was a lie. That wasn't true. All right, so join the club. We've been deceived before. We're being deceived now, and we will be deceived again at some point in the future. I don't know over what and when, but I just predict that, yeah, we've been lied to, and we've swallowed those lies in the past. We are being lied to today, and we're believing those lies today, and we're being deceived today. And that being true today and in the past would lead me to believe that at some time in the future, our government's going to lie to us again. And we're going to believe those lies again and be deceived again. past, present, and future. Now, they assure us that there's a consensus among scientists that global warming is real. Okay? Well, global warming is real. We can see that. Global warming being caused by the burning of fossil fuels and power plants is a lie. That's not true. And I showed you the numbers. All right, now let me remind you again. Now take the power plants that are burning coal today and all those trainloads of coal that are being burned up and converted to carbon dioxide and put into the Earth's atmosphere. It amounts to 6.5 gigatons of carbon dioxide. That's what we're putting into the atmosphere every year. Measurable. All right. Now take all the biomass in the world. That is all the dead plants that die. Now plants die. And when they die, they give off carbon dioxide. It's 150 gigatons per year. You got that? Now, if, and I'm going to use a big if here, if carbon dioxide caused global warming, which it doesn't, global warming causes carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide does not cause global warming. But even if it did, all we're doing is adding to the problem by 4 percentage points a year, which is inconsequential. And you know why it's inconsequential? Here's why. Mount Pinatubo, when it blew up back in 1994-95, in that two-year period, put in more carbon dioxide into the Earth's atmosphere than all of the activities of mankind from the Garden of Eden to today, 6,000 years. Now think about that. It may be true that we are adding to the conflagration, which I would liken to going up on top of a volcano and throwing 5 gallons of gas down into the cauldron. Yes, you would have to admit that throwing 5 gallons of gasoline down onto the fire pit did not do anything to put the fire out. But to sit there and say that volcanic eruptions are caused by throwing 5 gallons of gas into a volcano, you've got to have your head up the middle of your rectal region, kids. And that's what they're telling us. That's exactly what they're telling us. Burning fossil fuels, they tell us, is causing global warming, which is exactly like throwing 5 gallons of gas into a volcano and telling us that the eruption was caused by throwing this gasoline into the cauldron. Nonsense. Didn't do anything to put it out, but it didn't do anything to advance the volcanic eruption. Now, it's often said that there is a scientific consensus to the effect that climate change will be catastrophic and that on this question the debate is over. The present paper will demonstrate that the claim of unanimous scientific consensus was false, and it was known to be false when it was first made. And the trend of opinion in the peer-reviewed journals and even in the UN's reports on climate is moving rapidly away from alarmism, that among climate scientists, the debate on the causes and the extent of climate change is by no means over, and that the evidence in the peer-reviewed literature conclusively demonstrates that to the extent that there is a consensus, that consensus does not endorse the notion of catastrophic climate change. Now, what is the origin of this claim of consensus? David Miliband, the Environment Minister of the United Kingdom, was greeted by cries of rubbish when he told a conference on climate change at the Holy See in the spring of 2007 that the science of climate and carbon dioxide was simple and settled. Yet Miliband was merely reciting a mantra that has been widely peddled by politicians such as Al Gore and political news media such as the BBC, which has long since abandoned its constitutional obligation of objectivity on this, as on most political subjects, and has adopted a policy of not allowing equal airtime to opponents of the imagined consensus. Let me pause right here and point out that Ron Paul never got equal time in the debates, and therefore you never heard what his story was. And when you go to the debates, which when the Democrats finally settle on a candidate, and that candidate is going to have debates now with the Republican candidate, you're not going to hear anything from any other candidates than those two. And that's because the Republicans and the Democrats pay for and finance and support and promote those debates. And the other splinter parties do not, and they will not get equal time. So therefore, we never get an opportunity then to hear any opposing views to the Republicans or Democrats here in the United States. Well, it makes all the sense in the world, and I don't blame the Republicans and the Democrats. After all, if they're paying for it, they sure as hell aren't going to let in the socialists, the communists, and the greenies or anybody else. But listen, there are other people out there that have other views. And so when we come to science, I think that it would behoove all of us to listen to the other side before we saddle ourselves with this dollar a gallon carbon tax. Now, a buck a gallon is, you know, it's significant. But in the scheme of things, we're already paying right at $4 a gallon for gas. This summer, they tell us the gasoline is going to be $4. What the hell is the difference between $4 and $5? See, my gas tank holds about, 30 gallons of gas. So when I fill up my gas tank at $4 a gallon, let's say it's 30, that's $120. So what the hell is another 30? Well, the difference between 120 and 130 is $30, but it's not going to break me. I mean, you know, if I've got 120 to fill the tank, I probably have another 30. The guy that it's going to break his back is the guy that's only got $10. And when he goes into the gas station and he wants to buy gas, and gasoline's $5 a gallon, you know, $4 for the gas and $1 for the carbon tax, he can only get 2 gallons. Boys and girls, that's what's going to break the back. That's what's going to bring on famine on planet Earth. And that's because the poor people of the Earth, they also have to have energy, and they're scrambling. You raise that tax $1 a gallon, it's going to be a burden on Americans and Europeans. It is going to break the backs of India, Indonesia, and Africa. Those people are going to starve to death as a result of it. Now, the claim of consensus rests almost entirely on the inaccurate and now outdated single-page comment in the journal Science entitled The Scientific Consensus on Climate Change. In this less than impressive headcount essay, Naomi Oreskes, a historian of science with no qualifications in climatology, defined the consensus in a very limited sense, quoting as follows from the IPCC in 2001. She said, human activities are modifying the concentration of atmospheric constituents that absorbs or scatters radiant energy. Most of the observed warming over the last 50 years is likely to have been due to the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations. Boys and girls, the word consensus doesn't even appear in the statement. And Oreskes' definition of consensus falls into two parts. First, she states that humankind is altering the composition of the atmosphere. This statement is uncontroversial. For measurement has established that the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has risen over the past 250 years to such an extent that CO2 now constitutes 0.1% more of the atmosphere than in the pre-industrial era. However, on the question whether that alteration has any detrimental climatic significance, there is no consensus, and Oreskes does not state that there is. Consensus is propaganda. There isn't consensus, hasn't been, and nobody has claimed to, except Al Gore and the media and the politicians. The scientists haven't said that. And I went to the scientists and asked them. All right, boys and girls, I'm about out of time again. I'm going to have to remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.